Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Colleton.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Colleton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's show, what does the American invasion of Venezuela mean for global oil supply and prices? We speak to the FT's energy editor, Jamie Smith. Now, with the CAO deadline coming into view, we ask why more students don't consider apprenticeships. And plus, in a week of managers being sacked, we look at the economics of being in the dugout in the world of modern football. You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Colleton. Now, I want to share an observation about last week. Every single week, I put this episode of Taking Stock, or the week's episode of Taking Stock, on social media. Last week was the first time that when I put the three guests on social media on Blue Sky, each of the three of them had profiles there. So, an interesting point there about whether Blue Sky is on the rise and rise. Now, the producer of the show, John Fardy, sent me an email this week highlighting a report around the confidence women have of investing. And particularly, it quotes 85% of women don't feel confident to start investing. And my initial reaction was, I have to say, it really annoyed me. And the reason for this is that women are so, so capable when it comes to this, and it doesn't have to be this way at all. And I completely understand that there's a complete difference between confidence and competence. Women are more than competent to do it. So I would absolutely and wholeheartedly encourage women to really think about this, because it's far less complicated than you think. As somebody that started to learn how to do this without any basis in it at the time, when I was around about 20 in college was when I started looking into how to do this. It is so, so, so much easier than you think. Also, when you think about just the sheer enormous spending power that women have collectively in Irish households and right around the world, already women are investing an awful lot in day-to-day spending and in subsequently the future outcomes for their households. So they're already doing this all the time. And the inability to invest or make investing decisions can have a big impact on the pensions pay gap as well, which is much higher than the income wage gap. And in that case, that gets far more headlines. Now, I could go on and on and on about this, and I won't, because we have a show to get on with. But I would encourage, really encourage, anybody who might be thinking, I'd love to start investing, but I don't know how. There is a bazillion resources out there to help you get started, and you absolutely can do it. You can learn about it without ever investing a euro or a dollar or a pound, but please take the steps to go and learn and then decide if it's for you. Now, let's get started today. Well, it was once nicknamed Saudi Venezuela, and it was also called the Millionaire of the Americas. Yet President Trump ordered an invasion of Venezuela and then an arrest of President Maduro, or as he was called then. While this has major geopolitical consequences that we have continued to talk about right across the week, I want to look at the economic impact the invasion could have on the price of oil. Joining me now is Jamie Smith, US energy editor of FT.com. So, Jamie, Venezuela produces less than 1% of global oil output, with exports constrained by US sanctions and a naval blockade. But of course, it holds about 17% of the world's proven crude reserves. And that is according to the US Energy Information Administration. What is the impact of that in terms of the decision that President Trump made last weekend to invade and dethrone, we could say, President Maduro?
So there's a number of things going on here in the US, and one of them is the fact that the Trump administration had set their sights on ousting Maduro from the very outset. you know, and the US Secretary of State, Rubio, for political reasons, you know, he's close to the Cuban minority groups here in the US, had really wanted to shift Maduro. One of the reasons they want to do that is because actually Venezuelan oil keeps Cuba afloat. So there's sort of an interconnection there and some domestic politics involved. The second part of it is that Donald Trump has this plan to unleash American energy dominance around the world. And Venezuela has a lot of oil. 300 billion barrels are its estimated reserves, you know, which is more than the United States, more than Saudi Arabia. So there is a lot of potential in terms of its oil sector. And back in the 1970s, it was pumping 3.5 million barrels of oil per day. So there's a lot of oil. And if you can get to it, it could be potentially very lucrative. And what President Trump wants to do is he wants to get access to that oil and kick out Chinese and Russian companies that are big investors in the Venezuelan oil sector. So this is part of the energy dominance agenda.
Right.
Of his.
Now, you've mentioned Cuba, China, Russia, and I want to talk about them all. But I want to just go back to Venezuela for a moment, because US imports of Venezuelan crude sat at just 135,000 barrels a day at the end of last year. That's down from 1.4 million barrels per day in 1998. And that is significantly lower than the figure that you mentioned in the earlier 90s. How has there been such a decline in oil output in Venezuela over the last 30 years?
So, you know, it's three things, I think, really. You know, management, corruption, and US sanctions. So you had Chavez coming into control in Venezuela in the early 2000s, nationalizing the oil industry at that time, expropriating the assets of companies like ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. So when they did that, a lot of the big guys left. You know, they left the Venezuelan oil sector, and they have a lot of technology, a lot of skills. And there's also just been such political upheaval and economic upheaval in Venezuela. Huge amounts of skills have left the country as well. So you have this fact that the expertise, the technology, the skills, and then you've got these punitive sanctions, which the United States has put on Venezuela's oil sector. So they can't ship in the equipment that's needed to produce from these oil fields, and they can't export the oil easily. So at the minute, Venezuela's exports are actually about 800,000 barrels of oil per day. Most of that goes to China. A small amount goes to the United States. It's about 140,000, 150,000 barrels per day. And that's through a contract with Chevron. But interestingly, you know, the United States actually does have a need for the type of oil that Venezuela produces. It produces what's called heavy oil. It's really thick and sludgy. And they have calibrated their refineries along the US Gulf Coast to process this particular type of oil. So it's quite valuable to them. And without the Venezuelan oil, the huge amounts of Venezuelan oil that it used to get, it's been relying on Mexico and Canada. It still gets a lot of Canadian oil, but the Mexicans have stopped exporting so much of this heavy oil. So it actually does have a commercial value to try and fill up these Gulf Coast refineries. So I think that's part of it, but it's also, you know, this idea that Donald Trump wants US oil companies to go in and expand, extract oil, and use the oil, the Venezuelan's oil, to keep a thumb on the Venezuelan political leadership. He's going to use oil, which is the principal export earner, to control the country.
So, oil enables greater energy dominance. It keeps, as you say, Cuba afloat, which is close to Marco Rubio's heart. And then in addition, there's an enormous amount of oil there that the US wants to use itself for its own purposes. And of course, going back to the point you made at the beginning about China. If I quote you a statement from the National Security Strategy that I seem to be talking about every week since it came out, but anyway, it said the US wants to rebalance America's economic relationship with China, prioritizing reciprocity and fairness to restore American economic independence. How does diverting oil from Latin America away from China and to the US help the Americans achieve that restoration of economic independence away from China?
I mean, I don't think it actually does, to be quite frank, because America is the biggest oil producer in the world and the biggest gas producer in the world by far. So it has its economic independence in terms of fossil fuels. And China actually is pivoting away from fossil fuels. It has a much more dynamic approach towards renewables. So personally, I don't think that this actually has a massive impact on the economic security of the United States. But I do think that the MAGA brand and this idea that Trump has got of re-establishing the Monroe Doctrine, you know, this two centuries old idea that America must control its own backyard, I think that really plays into his philosophy. So he does not want Russian or Chinese companies in Latin America. And I think we're also seeing that in relation to Greenland. You know, he's talking about that needs to be made American. So, you know, this is definitely a personal philosophy that he's following through on. You know, he said it's not the Monroe Doctrine anymore. It's the Donroe Doctrine. So that's where Trump is going.
Last time we spoke, Jamie, we were talking about drill, baby, drill and the efficacy of it. And when we look at US shale producers now, let's go domestically to the US now. They remain profitable just about, but that's at about $60 a barrel. And tariffs have increased the cost of essential oil field equipment like pipes and drilling gear and generators, etc. If the price falls significantly now over the medium term, because he's encouraging US companies to go in. But as you were reporting this week, those US companies want guarantees from the US government because this didn't quite work out so well the last time that they were in Venezuela. But if so, that could dramatically increase supply and, of course, that could push prices down. So everybody is talking about Chevron and ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips. But what about domestic US shale oil producers? Does this actually go against them?
Yeah, it's a very interesting point you make. And we're about to publish a story on it, actually. My colleague's working on it.
You heard it here first, listeners of Taking Stock.
the US shale producers are furious.
They must be,
this,
of course.
Yes, about this adventure overseas at a time when they're really struggling. You know, the oil prices are low. They're currently below the break even, so they're not making any money at the minute. And production is sort of plateauing and it could start to fall if these low prices persist. So whenever Donald Trump comes up and says, we're going to subsidize, you know, American producers to go into Venezuela and produce oil, which is then going to compete with American producers, it leaves a very bitter taste in their mouths. So yeah, there is a lot of concern there.
And what do you think the rationale then is of the US government around its messaging of this? It's saying, right, we want big companies to go in here and spend billions, if not trillions, to spend or to invest in this particular area and at the same time hurt domestic producers. And while knowing that before any of this happens, they're already just about barely breaking even.
Yeah, I think what this is, it's a plan that has been written on the back of an envelope. We still don't know exactly how it's going to be, how it's going to end up. And there's a strong chance it could end up badly. So a lot of people in the oil sector, you know, we've been talking to them, they're quite concerned about this. I mean, even Chevron, which is the company with the one big
licensing
contract to work in Venezuela, it actually puts Chevron in quite a tricky position. I mean, in one way, it can boost its production, it can boost its export, and there's good commercial return there, you know, especially over the long term, if there's stability. But in the short term, it's put it in a tricky position because it almost looks like they are in lockstep with the US administration that are taking really unprecedented actions against a foreign government. So yeah, it's a very unclear and uncertain environment. And I think, you know, it's going to take a long time to try and see if we get a stable Venezuelan regime, which is, you know, pro-American, or if this all falls apart.
Okay, one of the things that everything you're saying is predicated on is money being invested, whether that's the US companies or whether it's the government. And the government, of course, now that I'm referring to is the US government, since they're now running Venezuela, of course. But a leaked document from Petróleos de Venezuela in 2021 said its pipelines had not been updated in 50 years and estimated the cost to return the country's systems to peak production levels would be $58 billion. And recently that figure was pushed up to 100 billion or more. Where is that money going to come from? Do you think it comes from private sector companies going in, or is Trump going to open up the checkbook?
It would be political suicide, I think, if he opened up the taxpayer checkbook and started to spend tens of billions of dollars of American taxpayers' money on developing oil fields in Venezuela. I think that would be really difficult to sell, particularly at a time when there's an affordability crisis in the United States. People are really suffering in terms of, you know, being able to afford things. That's going to be really tricky. And the other point is, it's going to be really, you know, the US oil majors, ExxonMobil, Chevron and ConocoPhillips, the last thing they want to do at a time when oil prices is very low is direct a huge amount of investment into Venezuela, which is politically uncertain at the minute. They also have other projects they're already working on around the world, you know, which are probably going to produce, you know, more profitable oil. So, you know, they're going to meet President Trump in the White House tomorrow. And it's going to be quite an interesting experience because in one way, they have to be really careful politically and they've got to bend the knee to the president. We've all seen what happens when you go to the White House and you're sitting down with Donald Trump. You have to show deference or things can get quite tricky quickly. But on the other side, they've got shareholders to think about. And, you know, they can't just go off willy-nilly investing tens of billions of dollars on expeditions, which could go badly wrong.
And
so
this is the thing, Jamie. I think there's a lot of assumptions being made. Number one, that that'll happen. Number two, that it'll push the price down. Number three is that everything will be going fine when there's the big deficit of infrastructure there in the first place, while everyone's looking around wondering, well, who's going to stump up the cash? Before we go, can I ask you from a 10,000 feet view, how do you see the world order being realigned around oil now between US, Cuba, who you mentioned, the OPEC countries, including Russia, who you mentioned, and of course, we never got to Canada. Is the world order changing through the lens of oil?
You know, I think particularly in this Venezuelan situation, you know, if America is successful, it gets to dominate the Venezuelan oil sector and actually does get to grow production, it really does trench America as the biggest producer for decades to come. And it would undermine, I suppose, the influence of Saudi and OPEC cartel. You know, they've already had their influence undermined over the last 10 years with American oil and other non-OPEC producers boosting production. This would accelerate that trend, which would have quite a geopolitical impact, I think, yeah.
And all the while, China continues to invest more and more in green energy and electrical vehicles along the way. So they say that it takes a long time for small actions to compound. And I think this is one of those times when we're at the beginning of that. Thanks so much indeed, Jamie Smith, US Energy Editor of FT.com. Fascinating conversation as always.
Thank you very much.
This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, we ask, why don't we value apprenticeships more? Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and for this week's trivia, I'm watching a series on Sky Documentaries at the moment, and it's brilliant. And it chronicles a decade. So every episode in the series, of which there's 10, is chronicling a decade. I'm going to give you three clues, and let's see if you can pick out what the decade is, and I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. Lyndon Johnson was president in the US. This decade showed the TV debate between Nixon and JFK. And this was the decade of a British invasion of rock music around the world. Let's see if you know which one I'm talking about. And as I say, I'm going to give you the answer at the end of the show. Now, the normal CAO deadline is fast approaching on the 1st of February. And naturally, for many households, the focus is going to be on picking courses in college. However, apprenticeships offer real earn and learn pathways to people who want to pursue their dream jobs. But what exactly is the economics of apprenticeships? Are they on the rise? What are the expected earnings in comparison to college courses? Lots of these questions and more will be answered, because joining me now to discuss this is guidance counsellor at Tyndall College, Carlo Gemma Lawler. So Gemma, I looked back at the action plan for apprenticeships from 2021, mm-hmm. and an ambitious government target was set for 10,000 apprentices to register by 2025. And that pretty much came to pass. Mm-hmm. And yet then in November 25, Minister Lawler said, this government is committed to growing apprenticeship registrations to at least 12,500 per year by 2030. Is that as ambitious an aspiration?
Well, it is if you look at the range of apprenticeships that hopefully will be on offer by that time. There's a range of over 100 different types of apprenticeships. which may be news to a lot of people, given that most people assume apprenticeships have to do with the traditional trades, for example, carpentry, electrics, hairdressing, and so forth. But actually, it has expanded into nearly every area of life in which we need a skilled person.
And I looked also at the CAO applications for 2025, and I saw that there was an increase of 6,525 applications in 1 year. Why is it that there is such an explosion of applications for CAO? And in comparison, the number of people applying for apprentices is growing at a much slower pace, given the 100 types of opportunities like you were mentioning.
That's an interesting question as to why. I mean, I have come across a number of difficulties with regard to securing an apprenticeship. So a lot of young people might be quite positive towards it from their careers classes and from the guidance of their guidance counsellors, because it is a very positive thing to do. But in reality, I think a lot of students, young people, have difficulty actually securing a placement.
Is that because they have to get a job with an employer who fundamentally sponsors them the whole way through?
I think that's the core of it. And I think maybe families are not aware of that, that an apprentice is an employee. And an employee has to be functional and has to be worth it, because the company has committed to the young person for 2, 3, 4 years in order for them to get their internationally recognised papers. So it's a huge commitment on the part of the business. So the business wants to hire the best possible young person they can, who will have the potential to complete the apprenticeship.
And Gemma, what advice then do you give to those families or those people who are facing those difficulties? They're either around awareness or actually getting the employer to offer them the opportunity.
Well, employers are restricted because employers have to be registered with Sullis in order to offer an apprenticeship to a young person. So that's where some people are falling down in. A number of students would have come back and said, well, you know, I thought I was getting an apprenticeship, but it wasn't. It was work with the employer because they're not registered with Sullis. So that can be a difficulty. So we need a clear map of who the employers are, who can take on apprentices that can be trained under Sullis. And that's available on apprenticeship.ie or generationapprenticeship.ie. So a bit of research has to be done. But if you take it from the other side, anybody who's thinking of getting an apprenticeship should really look at their work experience in TY, their work that they have done, and I mean work outside of school, in fifth year, and especially the summer from fifth year into sixth year. Does that align with what an employer would want? So, for example, if you were looking to do a stud farm manager's apprenticeship, which it is an apprenticeship, you would really want to have to show on your CV and in evidence in terms of references that I have done work in this area. I have proven evidence that I am reliable, that I can take instructions, that I'm willing to learn, I'm willing to graft. So it's a two-sided coin there. And maybe parents and young people aren't that aware, because maybe in the past it was, oh no, I'll just get an apprenticeship. And you walk down to the local farm or the local farrier or the local mechanic and work with him or her to get your apprenticeship. But now it's a completely different ballgame. It is a job. And I think a lot of the new apprenticeships that they're talking about, for example, if I'm looking at one here at the moment, a data analyst is an apprenticeship. I wonder, and it's just a question, how many school leavers are accepted onto that apprenticeship course? My guess is it is people who have already employed in that area and they're being offered a formal apprenticeship after 2 or 3 years. I'd like to see the statistics on it.
As I'm listening to you though, Gemma, what's becoming very clear here is that one needs to take care of their career from about 16 onwards if they want to apply for an apprenticeship. As you say, they think about their work experience in transition year, how they spend their summer between fifth and sixth year. It is a job. And the second thing is Generation Apprenticeship. It's a great website and I often refer people to it, as I do a lot of work with teenagers myself. But I was reading in that report, the 2021, that only came about since 2017. So in the grand scheme of things, this type of research and so on that you're talking about, it's not like the current generation of potential apprentices, their parents would have been doing that in the same way. But I want to get on to the point, of course, that lots of people are wondering, and that is the trajectory of one's earnings if they pursue an apprenticeship versus a graduate.
Okay. So I was talking about this with my fifth years, literally during the week before I knew I was coming onto the show here today. We were looking at the whole, the job of laboratory technician. So just as an example, so you could go to college and study a laboratory technician for 3 years and come out with a degree as a laboratory technician. And these are normally done in technological universities. They are done in technological universities in which you would get some work placement. Or you could hopefully secure an apprenticeship as a lab technician with one of the major pharmaceutical companies. If you were lucky enough to get the apprenticeship, you would start day one earning a small amount of money, but getting real work experience from day one and your internationally recognized papers by the time you end your apprenticeship. So financially, you have 3 years of earnings under your belt by the time you finish. You also have a 3 years fully recognized employable recognition evidence of that. Whereas the person who goes, and I'm not putting anybody off going to college, but the person who chooses to go to college is down financially because they've paid to go to college with their student contribution. They've missed out on a sizable amount of work experience, and they are competing with people who have completed the apprenticeship and have the work experience and the money behind them, finances that they have earned themselves over the previous 3 years. Now, to me, that's obvious. That's a no-brainer. So it depends on which actual trade you're looking at, and it depends on the actual ability to secure an apprenticeship. But if I was looking at being a laboratory technician, I would go the apprenticeship route.
And yet, lots of people would never consider it because it's just not on the radar. And I do wonder whether there is, whether we connotate prestige with going to college and perhaps stigma with doing an apprenticeship. Is that yes. changing? You're in the classroom with teenagers. Do you think that's changing?
It's the parents that I worry about. The teenagers are more aware of, or at least that they are in our school and in ETBs. We do promote apprenticeships to a very high level, and they do have a lot of access to guidance. And we would argue for and against, you know, in each particular case. But I think parents do have notions about, you know, my child is going to college. And it, to be honest with you, going to college is a real privilege. And I say that in the kindest of terms, in the sense that you are given permission for 3 or 4 years to continue your soul education and to continue to find yourself. And it does allow teenagers to grow up that little bit more, but it is not necessary to have a full and complete life. But it is a lovely 3 or 4 years to have if you can afford it.
Speaking of what you get as a result of it, Ireland sends more people to third level than anywhere else in the EU. What sort yes. of qualifications come with an apprenticeship, particularly when we say, right, a degree is a level 8 on the NFQ scheme? Mm-hmm. So if one does an apprenticeship, where on that level would they come out at? Would it be degree or otherwise?
It totally depends. It just like you can go to college and get a level six for a 2 year qualification. So that's a higher diploma. Or if you get a level 7, that's called an ordinary degree. If you do a, for example, a beauty therapy apprenticeship, your qualification is level 6. So that's the equivalent, but it takes 3 years with regard to getting that full qualification. It is possible to do a level 7, which is the equivalent of a 3 year degree on the NFQ, the National Framework of Qualifications. That's for a stud farm manager. Aircraft mechanics is 4 years, and that's proposed to be a level 6, but it's a 4 year long training. But the remuneration for that would be much higher than an average one. So it depends on the actual apprenticeship. They are all based on the NFQ, just like college courses are.
And as you said earlier, and having been paid along the way with the internationally recognised qualification and the evidence of working in a real situation as well. Mm-hmm. If we look at the pace of growth here, mm-hmm. in 2015, there was 26 female apprentices. There was 1,017 by 2020. In 2016, there were 27 apprenticeship programmes. And I checked Generation Apprenticeship before coming on air. There's now 78 programmes. Are we making a lot of progress, Gemma, or is all this off of just a very low base?
Okay. A lot of progress has been made towards what is standard in mainland Europe, continental Europe. And we're going through the models that we have in Germany and countries like that, where apprenticeships would be the norm. I think the idea is correct to actually introduce more on-the-job training and trades development across the whole spectrum of our life experience. Is enough being done? I see gaps. So the major gaps I see is the ability to secure the apprenticeship, as I said already, because it's not as simple as it was in the past. It's far more complicated. And I don't know if it's as fair as it was. Anyway, that's a whole different story. Are we doing enough? Are companies encouraged enough to take on young people? I've talked to some employers over the last few years who are very hesitant to take on young people who don't have a lot of evidence of employability.
It's a big risk, isn't it?
Because they've been let down.
Yeah, I mean, and also it's a big risk. You're taking on people for a considerable length of time. Also on Generation Apprentice, you'll see as well that companies are given a €2,000 grant in order to get that show on the road, and it's €1,000 two different times, which is still a small amount in the context of the risk that they're paying out, not just the money for the salary of the apprentice, but also the time they're spending in college, etc. You did mention Germany, though. And if we look around the world, Gemma, there's degree apprentices in the north, for example. As you mentioned, it's the norm in Germany, certainly a greater proportion of apprentices in young people in Switzerland. What can we learn in terms of best practice around the world that we should replicate here at home?
I think maybe more encouragement to the businesses who take on apprentices and more support for them in developing their new trainees. I mean, I've talked to an awful lot of employers who say it's the best thing that they've ever done, because they're training on their future staff to very high levels. They know what they're getting. They know what they're capable of. And a lot of employers are very, very happy when they have an apprenticeship scheme in full swing, and it works really well for them. But I think we need to encourage more businesses to explore the potential of taking on apprentices and joining the apprenticeship programme.
Well, you've certainly started that today here on Taking Stock. Thank you very much indeed for joining me, Gemma Lawler, Guidance Counsellor at Tyndall College Carlow. This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask, are football managers paid too much for what they deliver? Now, you're welcome back to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. I want to share a message with you that we got during the week after the piece where I interviewed Connor Pope last week around the economics of dry January. He says, "Hi, Susan. I'm off the booze a year now. I can't see the point of buying zero alcohol beer. What's the point of pretending you're drinking beer when you're off alcohol? Have a sparkling water or Coke." There's a bit of advice there now for you. Now, well, following a number of high-profile departures from some of the biggest football clubs in the world this week, namely Ruben Amorim from Manchester United and Enzo Maresca from Chelsea, we decided to take a look at the economics behind football managers at Premier League clubs. So from large-scale salaries, mountains of administrative work, endless pressure, there is a lot locked in behind the office door of these managers. Well, joining me now to crack open that door and shed some light on the matter is Chief Sports Reporter for The Times UK, Martin Ziegler, and football finance expert at the University of Liverpool, Kieran Maguire. So, Kieran, I'm going to start with you. The Premier League has introduced some new rules for this season. So the squad cost ratio is a financial regulation that limits Premier League clubs' on-pitch spending to 85% of their football-related revenue and net profit loss from player sales. What will this mean, do you think?
I don't think it's going to impact upon the bigger clubs. It's in many respects, it's sort of locking in the advantages, because if you take a club such as Liverpool or Manchester City that generates 700 million sterling, so that's around about 800 million euro. 85% of that is close to 700 million euro in wages. You take a smaller club that wants to be big, such as Newcastle or Aston Villa, they're probably on around about 350 million euro in revenue. So that means they've got half the revenue, they've got half the wages to spend. So it's locking in those existing advantages in football and it's sort of preserving the status quo.
So who do you think it will disadvantage?
It will disadvantage the clubs who you might want to put into the aspirational or ambitious sector. Perhaps they've got new wealthy owners. So I think you could look at Newcastle United, who are owned by the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund. You could look at Aston Villa, who are owned by the richest man in Egypt and one of the richest men in the United States in Edens and Sawiris, and say, well, if they want to spend money on their new toy, they're going to be prevented from doing so by these new rules.
Okay. We've got some figures there, Martin, from Kieran. And when we look at the 2023-24 season, Real Madrid became the first football club to record €1 billion in revenue. Picking up there in Kieran's point about Man United, it now has record revenues of £666.5 million. I got that from the last report from the last season. And yet it still lost €33 million. Can you talk us through their finances, please?
Manchester United, yeah. I mean, it's a record for them. It's not a record for the Premier League. Manchester City have made more. But they made that in a season where they didn't have Champions League football. So you can think they could perhaps add another, 80 to 100 million possibly, depending on what they do, if they were to qualify for the Champions League. And, of course, the big one is that, you know, well, they build this huge new stadium, which would absolutely become a cash cow for the fans, hospitality, and be able to actually rival those Real Madrid revenues in the future. But, I mean, obviously the big question there is who's going to pay for this huge new stadium, which is going to, you know, at a conservative estimate, is going to cost £2 billion. Who's going to pay for that?
Well, Martin, in order to clear the money in order to build it, it has lost cut more than 250 staff members. That was made redundant in the first round of cuts. And also, its total operating expenses are down 4.5%. Obviously, we'll talk about the manager or the head coach that was also asked to leave the building this week. But do you think that Man United's finances have been run well in the past season?
I mean, I think that in terms of the sort of commercial income, that they're pretty good. Whether the cost-cutting regime that was brought in by the Ineos operation has been made a huge difference, I'm not so sure. I think, you know, the biggest outgoing is players' salaries, and that has dropped a bit. But that's mainly because they've not been in the Champions League. So I think it might be a bit of a side issue, this, you know, the Ineos cost-cutting operation. I think Manchester United is such a big brand that it's actually difficult not to make a decent fist of it in terms of commercial income, merchandise, matchday income. But so much actually depends about success on the pitch. And that is probably the reason why Ruben Amorim, although, you know, there are personality clashes as well, I think the bottom line, the reason why he's departed this week is because Manchester United now facing the threat of a third consecutive season not being in the Champions League. And without, you know, that huge amount of money that brings in, as well as, you know, they have penalty clauses with their sponsors such as Adidas. So I think it all boils down to success on the pitch. You know, you can be the best, most brilliant commercial operation in football, but that's no good if you can't replicate that by being brilliant and successful on the field of play.
Right, Kieran. Moving then on to the amount of money spent on managers now. Martin there mentioned numbers related to Man City, for example, which are higher than Man United. But naturally enough, when you look at Man City, we look at Pep Guardiola, who's paid about 20-odd million a year. So how do clubs measure the return on investment of a manager? Of course, there is going to be the performance on the pitch. But how then does that translate back to what the board or the owners of the club decide has been a good outcome?
Well, I think you could use the analogy of a football coach being similar to that of a fund manager. And in the case of Manchester United, Ruben Amorim is looking over a fund which costs somewhere in the region of 1.4 to 1.5 billion euro. If you look at Maresca, who was at Chelsea, he was closer to 2 billion euro. And therefore, you're looking at for a return on investment. Now, in football, that return on investment, yes, it is looked at through a financial lens, but you only make that return really upon the sale of the club rather than when it's being run. So therefore, the other key performance indicator you'd be focusing on is success on the pitch. And that can be very mixed. In the case of Maresca, he won two trophies in his first season at Chelsea, but that wasn't deemed to be enough. And in the case of Amorim, Manchester United really have to be in the top four or top five, as Martin hinted, in order to be able to tap into Champions League resources from next season. And clearly the board of directors didn't have faith that he'd be able to deliver.
Now, though, what also Martin hinted at was that it was more than money. The personality clash was also part of it. So do you think, after all, he was only 14 months there. Do you think they made the right decision based on his ability to deliver on the pitch?
Well, if you take a look at his track record in Portugal, it was very good. And also, I think you've got to look at the resources that he had to operate with. Whilst Manchester United has spent over 2 billion euros since Sir Alex Ferguson retired in 2013. I think with the exception of Bruno Fernandes, you can't think of one as successful transfer. So I think there are other issues. And I think to a certain extent, Amorim's being made the fall guy for failures at the club to identify talent, just like you would, if you're operating a fund management team, it's got to be other people who are helping to sort of look at the portfolio of investments. And that portfolio at Manchester United, I think the politest way you can describe it is mixed.
That is a polite way indeed to do that. So, Martin, can I ask you to think through the lens that Kieran invites us to do, and which is to look at a football manager as a fund manager. How do you think Ruben, 14 months at Manchester United, are being judged in terms of value for money then?
Well, I mean, I did an analysis, actually, which Kieran contributed to, which is for the 23-24 season. And obviously the majority of which Ruben Amorim was in charge. And basically, it turned out, in terms of value for money, that Manchester United side that season was the worst since the launch of the Premier League in 1992. No other team had performed as badly for the amount they'd spent on transfers, player wages and agents. So it actually didn't get much worse than that. So, you know, you could actually say there'd been a significant improvement this season. But it was a terrible season. It wasn't all his fault. You know, he came in November. But actually, it was disastrous, wasn't it? I mean, they very nearly, you know, they could have gotten the Champions League by winning the Europa League, but they lost that to Tottenham Hotspur. And that it was a season to forget. They spent $250 million over the summer on new players. They bought some decent players in, but things still haven't worked out. So I think, value for money, he's done very, very badly indeed. So, I think that is the bottom line, and that's why they got rid of him, despite the fact they're saying they're going to give him lots of time to to make a difference. Clearly, he was frustrated, and they thought enough is enough.
Martin, isn't it interesting, though, and Kieran did it just right there in the answer before I asked you that question, how so often Manchester United's record is always, it always harks back to Alex Ferguson. Sir Alex Ferguson, to give him his full title. Like, there's been several managers between him in 2013 and now, and yet that is always the benchmark. Now, obviously, the success of the club hasn't been ever what it was when he was manager, but do you think, is there any manager out there that can rise to that challenge of basically filling his boots?
Well, I think that there is, but I do also think the problem has run deeper than it's not just the manager, and I think that's a lot of part of the problem, and that has been the problem. You know, the ownership has always been sort of remote. You know, it's the Glazers based in America. I think the transfer policy has been flawed, perhaps, when after David Gill, the chief executive, left with Alex Ferguson at the same time in 2013. I don't think he was ever properly replaced by anyone. particularly good. So I think it's a combination of factors. I think managers are out there, but they need to have good backing with the executives in the boardroom and right to the very top. But unless there's a sort of cohesive structure, then it doesn't work. I mean, we'll see what happens with Jim Ratcliffe and the Ineos operation. They're the people who are running the club at the moment. It's I think the jury's still very much out on whether they're going to be a success too.
Well, Kieran, let's say that they were to knock on your door. Man United spent £250 million, as was already mentioned there, during the transfer window. And yet, until this season, United had never before missed out in two successive Champions League seasons. With less than half the season to go, it looks like they're one of the six clubs competing for that fourth spot. What advice would you be giving to the club now?
I would concentrate on being smart rather than being big. If you take a look at the success that Liverpool have had, they recruited people who could understand where value arises when it comes to recruiting football players. They then recruited a coach who they felt could deliver with that particular bunch of players. And they achieved that, first of all, with Jurgen Klopp, and secondly, with Arne Slot last season. Remember, Liverpool spent, what, €30 million in winning the Premier League last season. So they have been super smart. They've used sort of the money ball approach, but that's not glamorous. And I think that's part of the problem with Manchester United. Manchester United's a soap opera more than a football club. And therefore, you're having to operate under soap opera rules and Hollywood rules as much as you are to sort of the rather dull, analytical, forensic, spreadsheet-based approach, which perhaps is required in modern football, and which you do see at Liverpool, you do see at Manchester United, and you do see at Arsenal. Sorry, at Manchester City, and you do see at Arsenal.
Well, if it seems to work there. One last thing I want to ask you, Kieran. I looked at Man United's first quarter fiscal 26 results, and I saw their sponsorship revenue was down 9.3%. Now, I know Martin earlier on said that from a commercial point of view, that the commercial revenues that they're generating are pretty good, but that is quite significant. And when I looked at why the sponsorship revenue was down, it said due to a change in their commercial partner mix. Now, maybe that's a nice way of putting it as well, but do you see this continuing on a downward trajectory if Man United continue performing the way they have been?
Potentially, yes. Adidas, for example, they have a 10 million sterling, so that's what, an 11 million euro penalty. If Manchester United don't qualify for Europe, Manchester United did have a training ground sponsor kit deal. That's not been replaced, and that expired last season. Why is that the case? It's because sponsors want to be associated with winners, and Manchester United aren't winners at present. So therefore, unless they start to deliver more on the pitch, they are going to find it that much more difficult to replace those particular relationships and to sign deals at the value that they consider to be worthy of a club of the stature of Manchester United.
Well, my mother is a diehard Man United fan. I don't think, no matter what happens to them, she'll still be supporting them anyway. So thanks indeed so much for joining me. Chief sports reporter for the Times UK, Martin Ziegler, and football finance expert at the University of Liverpool, Kieran Maguire. Thanks so much for joining me indeed.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and possibly even learned something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, for the answer to my trivia question. So here it was. I'm watching a series on Sky documentaries at the moment, and there's 10 episodes in this series and it chronicles a decade. I gave you three clues and I was asked you to pick it out. So, in this decade, Lyndon Johnson was the president in the US. The TV debate was shown between Nixon and JFK, and there was a British invasion of rock music around the world. Which one was it? It was, of course, the 60s. And if I'd mentioned things like civil rights, JFK getting shot, the Beatles, etc., it would have made it far more obvious. Great series on Sky documentaries. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the Go Loud app. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research was Dylan Hand. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day. And once again, a very happy new year, and I look forward to chatting to you again next week.
This is the new Weight Watchers. It works for members like Jojo, who's learning simple, healthy habits. Sharia, who's making progress with meds. And Kim, who still gets to eat what she loves. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Watch your life open up. Watch your story shift. Watch what you're capable of.
Watch it work. Get started today at WeightWatchers.com.